So with that, I give the floor to Patty M.
Thank you, Risa, so much. Thank you to everyone for your incredible service during this convention. I feel like if we were all in the same room together, we would be giving you all a standing ovation. So I'll just give them a virtual ovation right now. Thank you so much. Buenos dias, bon dia, good morning, everyone. My name is Patty. I'm a compulsive overeater. And my disease has taken a lot of different forms, as you will hear in my story. But for now, I'll just say I'm a compulsive overeater in recovery for today, because we recover one day at a time. For me, often it has been 1 hour at a time, certainly one meal at a time, but all in all, it's one day at a time. My abstinence date is July 31st, 1987. So what is that? That is 34 plus years in recovery. When I came into OA, I was 33 years old. So y'all, I don't know how this happened, but I have now been in recovery longer than when I wasn't. And you too can claim the same seat as long as you keep coming back. It's been a joy aging and now being a senior citizen, even though I came into OA in my youth. So I was born in New York on Long Island, which is a very suburban area, about 45 minutes from Manhattan. Great place to grow up. Great schools, safe neighborhoods, lots of kids, you know, on the same street, lots of friends to play with, and then Manhattan 45 minutes away with all the art and culture and diversity that that city, you know, adds to our lives. So it was a great place to grow up. I lived on Long Island until I was 19 years old, and then in 1973, moved to Atlanta. I grew up in post-World War II suburbia. So for us Americans, I would be called a baby boomer. My parents lived in New York City, and like many, many married couples, they moved from New York City to Long Island simply because of the neighborhoods and the schools and to get away from some of the challenges of raising a child in the city and the school issues and crime and whatnot. So my parents moved to Long Island in 1950. They built a lovely house in a small town called Malvern, and that's where I lived till I was 19 years old. I am the youngest of three. I have two older brothers, and so the five of us lived in this house, and of course, everything looked great on the outside. We had a great home. You know, we had your typical family in my neighborhood, which was two parents and three kids. My parents were thrilled when I was born because they had my two older brothers and they really wanted a girl. My mother told me that they were going to keep having children until they had a girl. And so finally they did. And I was born and they called me Princess Patty. So life should have been great, right? Here I was, born into this family, beautiful house, great neighborhood, loving parents, and things started to change very quickly. So I was born cross-eyed. I've had 3 eye surgeries to correct my eyes, and I still have trouble with my eyes from time to time, especially if I'm stressed or tired. But what happened, I believe, looking back, is that there was some kind of inner shame for me that developed very, very early on in my infancy, because I didn't look like others. And I believe that even as a baby, I internalized that when people looked at me, they knew something was wrong with me, something wasn't right. And it wasn't until I was almost 3 years old that I had my first eye surgery. And from the age of 3 up to adolescence, my eyes looked basically straight. So I looked pretty normal. You wouldn't know necessarily that I was born that way. But when you look back at family pictures, there's very few pictures of me looking straight on. Most of the pictures of me are me looking down or from the side or from the back, because I think my parents just didn't want to capture me, you know, the way that I really looked. So I think that that shame about my appearance and about my body started initially really with that. By the time I was 4 years old, my mother's mother passed away. My father's parents had died before I was born. So when my mother's mother passed away when I was 4, she was my only grandmother. Between the ages of 4 and 6, I had a number of extended family members pass away. And then when I was 6 years old, in December of 1960, there was a terrible blizzard on Long Island. And if you Google blizzard, December 1960, New York, there's article after article after article about this incredibly devastating blizzard that happened. And the morning of the blizzard, my father went outside to shovel snow. And so we would be able to get out of the house, hopefully, when it was safe. And the walkway from our front door to the sidewalk would be clear. Shortly after he came in the house, after shoveling snow, he had a heart attack. And my mother called the doctor. Back then, as someone else shared in their story earlier in the convention, back then, doctors made house visits. The doctor was able to get to our house despite the blizzard. It was early enough in the day that he was able to drive there. And he confirmed that my father had had a heart attack, but he lived. He survived it. And he told my mother that just let him rest for the rest of the day and he'll be okay. Well, a few hours later, my father had a second heart attack and it killed him. And we had a live-in housekeeper, and the housekeeper shuffled my brothers and I upstairs into one of my brother's bedrooms, closed the door, so that we would not be a witness to what was going on in the house. So, you know, looking back, I know that at some point, you know, an ambulance would have come and they would have taken my father's body out of the house. And then within a short period of time, we had the funeral. I usually say as part of my story that by the time I graduated from elementary school, at the end of 6th grade, I had been to more funerals than most people that I know of have been to in their lifetime. So death was very close to me, you know, through all of my growing up. when I was 16, my mother's father passed away. And he lived in Connecticut. We lived in Long Island, which was just a few hours drive. And we drove to Connecticut for my grandfather's funeral. Even though I loved my grandfather, I wasn't particularly that close to him. He lived in a different state. But, you know, we had the funeral, we went to the cemetery, and then we went back to my grandfather's home. And we were all sitting in the living room chatting like you do after a funeral. And I just started bawling my eyes out. And I felt so out of control and so taken aback at the depth of my emotion. I did not understand it, that I kind of ran out of the room and ran into one of the bathrooms. And I was standing in the bathroom looking at myself in the mirror, you know, and I'm crying and snot's coming down my nose. And I'm like, why? What is going on with me? Why am I sobbing like this over my grandfather? And I had a small spiritual awakening in that moment that I wasn't only grieving the loss of my grandfather, I was grieving the loss of my father and all of those other family members that had passed by the time I was 16 years old. And by the time I got into OA, guess what happened? All that grief resurfaced in a new way. And so I had a lot of feelings to deal with once I let go of the food. When my father passed away, that became a bit of a rite of passage for my mother. She was single with three children, but we were quite affluent. And so she was no longer bound by the expectations and the ties of a married American housewife in the early 60s. And so she joined a lot of organizations. She got involved in things she may not have been involved with if she had a living husband. And she eventually started dating again, and she became very, very involved in her own life. And as I mentioned earlier, we had a live-in housekeeper. And so she didn't have to worry about cooking meals or being home when we got home from school, or, you know, taking us places and doing all the things that, you know, the ideal mom in 1960s suburbia might have been doing. And so I was basically raised by our housekeeper, and had very little affection or attachment really for my mother, because she had very little attachment to us kids. Unfortunately, my middle brother had a lot of mental problems, and she was taking him to a psychiatrist by the time he was 10 years old. And that brother grew up to be a sociopathic pedophile. And I, along with some other girls in the neighborhood, were among his first victims. So when my father was alive, and I've learned this more from talking to my oldest brother, when my father was alive, you know, he was a pretty stern, firm kind of guy. But when he passed away, it was kind of like all hell broke loose in my house. And I grew up very afraid to take a bath, very afraid to go to sleep at night, very afraid of what my middle brother was going to do next, because not only was there sexual abuse, but I really believed that he was trying to kill me. And I have a lot of things that he did that I could go into about that. So needless to say, I grew up in a very, very unsafe household where my oldest brother, who was 8 years older than me, just couldn't stand being around the family. So as soon as he could, when he started getting, you know, an active social life and involved with things in school, he was home as little as possible. And that left me and my sociopathic pedophile brother, you know, basically in the care of a housekeeper who couldn't watch us 24 hours a day. So it was not a safe place to grow up. And despite the fact that everything looked great on the outside, it was far from great on the inside. Another thing that I internalized from growing up in the family that I did was there really weren't any other families that didn't have two parents where I grew up. And so there were things like Father's Day would roll around and I was in first grade, and our teacher would decide that everyone in school was supposed to make Father's Day cards. And I wouldn't know what to do because my father was dead. And so I would go up to the front of the room and tell the teacher that I didn't know what to do, and she didn't know what to tell me. You know, today, when there's a loss in a family, there's support and awareness. Whether it's enough or not, I can't say. But back then in 1960, there was no support and no awareness. And, you know, when I would make new friends and go over their houses, you know, that didn't live in my immediate neighborhood, and maybe their parents didn't know that my father had passed away, and they would say, well, tell us about your family. What does your father do? And I would say, oh, he passed away. And I would notice, even at the age of 6, that the adult I was talking to became immediately uncomfortable and didn't know what to say. And I took that on in a way that made me feel like it was my job to make it okay for them. And so I grew up with this pattern that if there was discomfort or sadness or someone didn't know what to say or do, it was my job to fill the gap and make it okay. So here I was, instead of being the 6-year-old who lost a parent, getting comforted and getting support, I became the caretaker of the adults around me. And in order to do that, I had to unplug or disconnect from who I was and what I was feeling. And that act of unplugging and disconnecting, a little later afterwards, turned into compulsive overeating and compulsive food behavior. So that's basically what my life looked like. When my father passed away, fortunately, he left us in a very good financial situation. My mother's tax attorneys told us that she had to spend the money or she'd have to pay capital gains taxes. So she very quickly built a pool in the backyard, did a lot of redecorating of our house. So our lives on the outside looked better than ever. You know, when I was in second grade, my birthday party was a pool party because my birthday is in June. And so here I am, this little 7-year-old girl, you know, having a pool party, and we're all wearing party dresses and party shoes, and you know, they're singing me happy birthday and we're playing games. And inside, y'all, I was dying. I was absolutely dying. So that's a little bit about my childhood. Fast forwarding into adulthood.
Reminder, 25 minutes left.
Thank you. I think it was in my adolescence that I started being really, really much more aware of my size and my weight and how much I weighed. On the outside, I was a very normal weight. If anything, you might say I was slender. But I became very, very conscious of food and weight and calories and the size of my stomach. And life started to become about better than or less than. So if you were thinner than me, you were better than me. If you were bigger than me, you were less than me. If I was thinner than you, I was better than you. And this was the age of Twiggy. I don't know if all of you know who Twiggy is or was. She was a model and she was this big around. And so I start my obsession with food and weight and the size of my body took off big time in my adolescence. By the time I was a senior in high school, I had convinced myself that I was fat, even though I wasn't. I was obsessively weighing. And in the heat of the summer, I would get on my bicycle and I would ride to a place that had one of these commercial weight loss programs. And I would go in and they would give you like these frozen meals, and a lot of the meals were too small and left me hungry. So I would eat more than one meal. They also have these frozen desserts, and there would be a box with like four different servings of dessert. And I would take that home and I would eat the entire box, you know? And so my binging started getting more and more, and I was gaining weight and I was terrified. And y'all, I would say that when I enrolled in that weight loss program, I weighed 119 pounds and I was 5'3". So I was far from fat. Was I, you know, Twiggy skinny? Absolutely not, but I was far from fat. And that's how distorted my body weight was. If I sat in a room full of friends, you know, to be perfectly honest, I wasn't present to what was happening in this situation because I was so busy looking at my stomach and looking at y'all's stomachs and seeing who's fatter, looking at who had the thinnest thighs, looking at the shape of people's arms, looking at cheeks, you know, looking at whether you could cross your legs and then kind of twist your foot around the bottom of your calf, you know? And so I became absolutely obsessed with comparing. And, you know, I've heard it say in this program that this is a disease of comparison. And I certainly was absolutely obsessed with comparing myself to whoever else was in the room. The binging got worse and worse. And then I had a girlfriend in high school who told me about this crazy diet where you could only eat two different foods. You could eat hot dogs and pineapple ice cream, and you would eat hot dogs for 5 days and nothing else, and then pineapple ice cream for 5 days. And, you know, we did that for a few months. And then I learned that if I starved all day and only ate dinner, I could lose weight. So I tried all these different ways to control my weight and control my binging, and none of it was working. And I was getting bigger and bigger, and I was panic struck. When my oldest brother was in college, he got involved in a way of life called macrobiotics. And all of the girls that I saw around him that did this macrobiotic diet thing, which was basically, you know, vegetarian and brown rice and beans and organic vegetables and all of this, I decided that was the perfect way to eat. I was going to be macrobiotic and I was going to be thin like all these women. And so for the next, I would say 10 years, y'all, I tried to eat perfectly. Every day I tried to eat perfectly, and every day I failed. And that idea of eating perfectly followed me into Overeaters Anonymous and haunted me for the first few years of my recovery. I went away to college. I got into alcohol and drugs like a lot of people do in college. And that seemed to kind of take the place of what I was doing with food. But when I realized that that behavior wasn't so healthy either, I started letting go of that. And the more I let go of that, the more the food started getting really, really bad. When I was in my early 30s, my mom was diagnosed with cancer. About 3 years later, she passed away. And during the time that she was dying, I had very high anxiety, and I was alternately starving and binging and starving and binging. And then I started into compulsive exercise. And I had never heard the term exercise bulimic until I got into Overeaters Anonymous. So I would alternately starve and binge during the day. And then after work, I would go to the gym and I would do a 1 hour aerobics class. Then I would get on the treadmill for an hour. And then I would work out with free weights. So I'd be in the gym for about 3 hours. And I did this 6 to 7 days a week for several years. And despite the binging, I was able again to maintain a somewhat normal appearance. But I started having physical and problems from doing so much aerobics and exercise. So by the time my mom was in the hospital and she was passing away, I had been starving, binging, compulsive exercising my way through life. My mom passed away. At the time, I was engaged to someone to be married. And shortly after while she was still dying, he ended the engagement, and then he ended the relationship. And then my mom passed away. And that devastating loss of my mom, even though we weren't close, she was my only parent most of my life, and the loss of that relationship, we'd been together about 7 years, propelled me toward recovery. So I got into therapy, and I started sharing with the therapist very gradually what my life was looking like. And of course, I had a lot of grief and a lot of grief work to do. And y'all, he gave me a big book to read. And I took the big book home and I looked through it. And I came back the next week for our next session. I gave it back to him and I said, well, thank you very much, but I don't relate to any of it. I don't relate to any of it. But y'all, I was in a lot of pain. I was in a lot of pain. And I was in, you know, a sort of kind of withdrawal from that relationship I had been in so long. And I started realizing that maybe there were some things about me in my life that needed to change. So someone told me about a 12-step program about relationships. And I decided I would go there. And I met a woman at one of those meetings. And, you know, we were chatting after the meeting like people do. And she just casually mentioned, like, if I open a box of this food item, I'm eating the whole box. If I open a bag of this food item, I eat the whole bag, you know? And she talked about her binging behavior. And I looked at her and I said, I eat like that too. I had never heard anyone talk about eating the way that I ate. And she said that she went to Overeaters Anonymous. And I said, what is that? And she told me about it. And she told me about a meeting. And I went to a meeting and I remember it was very small. There were like three people there. They were all quite large. I was normal sized and I had a hard time relating. But they said, keep coming back. And they gave me a meeting schedule. And so I went to another meeting and then I went to another meeting and I went to another meeting and I sat in those rooms. And I looked at me and I looked at y'all and I said, I don't know if I belong here, but what I'm doing isn't working. And that was in April of 1987. So I spent April, May, June, July, I spent 4 months in the rooms, looking around, deciding why I didn't belong. And one night, I was at a Friday night meeting, very large meeting, and they gave out chips in the meeting. And someone was at the front of the room and held up a white chip. Back then, the chip was white. Now, I think the welcome chip is silver in most rooms, but back then it was white. It was the surrender chip. Someone held up a white chip and said, "Is there anyone that wants to try our life one day at a time?" And something lifted me out of my chair and pushed me to walk to the front of the room and grab that white chip. And I turned around, you know, I guess everybody clapped or whatever, and she probably hugged me. And I turned around and walked back to my chair. And I said, "What the F did I just do? What have I gotten myself into?" And they said, "Keep coming back." And so I did. And so I did. And so I did. And in 1987, there were a lot of things that we said back then that we don't say as much in the rooms these days. But, you know, they told me, go to meetings, get a sponsor, and don't eat no matter what. No matter what. And go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And y'all, I went to 90 meetings in my first 90 days. I went to another 90 meetings. I went to another 90 meetings. And by the time I had 2 years of abstinence, I was still going to a meeting every single day. That's not necessarily my story today, but that's what I needed when I came in. I needed a total immersion in the program of Overeaters Anonymous. And they told me 3 meals a day and an abstinence snack if needed. That's a lot of what we did back then. And the idea of 3 meals a day was terrifying to me. Terrifying, too much structure. And not eating between meals, except for maybe an abstinence snack, which would maybe be a piece of fruit in the evening if I was up particularly late. Absolutely terrifying. And, you know, for the first little bit, it seemed like abstinence to me was like about giving up a lot and about deprivation. And somebody said to me in a meeting, "You deserve the gift of abstinence." And that was a total 180 for me, to think of abstinence as a gift. And today I know that abstinence is a gift, and it's one of the most treasured gifts in my life. I talked to people about giving up certain foods, sweets and desserts and things I needed to let go of at the time. And they said, "You don't have to give anything up. You just have to be willing to let it go." And that idea of becoming willing to let something go is something I've carried through my recovery all these years. When I'm resistant to letting something go, that my higher power is telling me loud and clear, like a billboard on this side of the highway, "This has got to go. It's no longer serving you." I pray for the willingness. I pray for the willingness. Sometimes on my knees, because I need to surrender. A lot of stuff happened in my life, you know, and you've heard other speakers talk about, you know, loss and life changes and life happening in recovery. A lot of my life has happened in recovery since I've now been in recovery longer than I haven't been. I got a lot of memories about the sexual abuse in my childhood when I got abstinent. And that's a lot of what my using food was stuffing that down. And my brother, the pedophile, was in graduate school to become a marriage and family counselor. And to earn his way through graduate school, he ran a gymnastics school, which was full of young girls. And when I had about two, three years abstinent, I knew I had to do something because those girls weren't safe. It wasn't enough for me to go to therapy and work the steps around the abuse. I had to be an advocate for other victims and potential victims. And I reported my brother to a number of authorities as a pedophile and shared that he had abused me. And to make a long story short, it turned out that at the same time US Customs and the FBI had been watching my brother because of some other things he was doing with child pornography. And the whole thing blew up. And my brother flew back to Kennedy Airport from France, and he had some things in his possession that the customs agents in New York grabbed. And for some reason, my brother was able to get away from the customs agent and call an attorney. And the attorney told him, get out of there as fast as you can, get on the next plane out of the country, and don't come back because you will spend the rest of your life in jail. And to this day, my brother is on the lam. I know that I had a hand in that. And a couple of years later, I was subpoenaed to go to New York to testify against my brother, or for my brother, they didn't know, in front of a grand jury in New York City. And I did it all abstinent. I've lost friends abstinent. I got married abstinent. I got pregnant abstinent. I had a baby abstinent. I sent that baby off to college abstinent. I got divorced abstinent. I've been rich. I've been poor. I've been married. I've been single. I've been young. I've been old. Abstinent, thanks to my higher power and this program. When I became an empty nester, after I sent my kid off to college, I was living alone for the first time in 20 years, y'all. I've lived alone abstinent, and I've lived with a family abstinent. It's all possible. All the recovery in the world, all the recovery in the universe is there for us if we want it and if we are willing to work for it. After my beautiful daughter went to college, she came out to me as gender questioning and later confirmed that she was a he. My beautiful daughter transitioned to now my adorable, precious son. 4 years later now, I have a transgender son who I love every bit as much as I love my daughter. And I grieve the loss of my daughter. And I brought that grief into the rooms and I shared it with y'all and I got through it abstinent. And I truly believe in this program of Overeaters Anonymous, that thanks to my higher power and all of you, I can be abstinent one day at a time. I can live by the principles of this program. I can pick up the tools any hour of the day or night. And I can be free, free from the obsession, the comparison, the self-hatred, and the self-abuse that my disease and can inflict in me, and I'm not immune. It's one day at a time. I heard someone say in the rooms, you know, when I'm in a meeting, my disease is doing push-ups in the parking lot, you know, and there's so much I could share with you, but I'm aware of the time. And I just wanted to
gentle reminder, 5 minutes left.
Okay. I wanted to read something from step 12 in our 08, 12, and 12. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about my daily program, because some others have done that when they shared their story, and I found it really, really helpful. What I would say is that, you know, we all know what the tools are, right? We read them in most meetings. But I want to talk a minute about sponsorship. I can't tell you how many fourth and fifth steps I've worked with sponsees, and what an honor it has been to be a person that people trust enough to tell their deepest, darkest secrets. And because sponsees have been willing to do that, it's helped me be willing to do that. And I've gotten so much relief. I've sponsored newcomers who can't get out of the food. I've sponsored newcomers that become abstinent and have long-term abstinence. I've sponsored people who are chronic relapsers. Everyone is welcome in my book, because we keep what we have by giving it away. And by giving it away, you help my recovery. And I'm grateful for every phone call, every text, every request, and every opportunity to be of service. And I want to say thank you to the committee for asking me to be the closing speaker. At first, when I was asked to do this, I thought, oh, no pressure, right? Closing speaker. Better be good. But, you know, my story is just my story. You know, and your story is your story. And I hope if you haven't already, you get to share it with someone. And I'm grateful to all the speakers and all the panelists during the convention that have shared. It's just been a great convention. And again, you know, a hearty bravo to the committee. And thank you for all your service. And thank you again for asking me to do this today. So I want to just read something from the 12th step in our 08, 12, and 12. This is the second to last paragraph in step 12. And it says, we who began working the steps in order to recover from compulsive eating now find that through them, we have embarked on a lifelong journey of spiritual growth. From the isolation of food obsession, we have emerged into a new world, walking hand in hand with our friends and our higher power. We are now exploring this world using the great spiritual principles embodied in the 12 steps as the map to guide our way. We gratefully follow in the footsteps of many others who have walked this way before us, and we are gratified to be making footprints of our own for others to follow. Thank you for letting me share.
Gracious. Patty, thank you so, so much. Oh my goodness. What an incredible story. I am so thankful and grateful to hear what you have had to say. I am just blown away and all over goosebumps. So we don't have very much time left for the rest of this workshop. I know we all want to have an abstinent lunch before we go to the intergroup idea sharing workshop at 1. So we're only going to take a few questions from the chat. If you have questions for Patty, please put them in the chat. You can send them to me. You can send them to everyone. That's fine too. And I'm going to read them to her to help facilitate, to help facilitate. So we have a comment actually from Zoraida. Patty, thank you very much for sharing in such an honest way. What you have shared helps me a lot in my recovery. I thought that was a wonderful thing to say.
Gracias.
And then I have someone who has said, oh my God, Sarah's iPad has said, oh my God, thank you so much for your story. Would you be willing to share your telephone number?
Yes.
And she has shared her phone number and I will send that to you directly.
Thank you.
A lot of love yous and thank yous because you're so fabulous. While Liz S. says, wow, Patty, your story was a gift, a perfect closing to this wonderful conference. That's so kind. I feel like that's kind. So there was, please share your contact information, phone, email, and I'll send you that number. That's from Melissa. And in case she was asking about me, I'll share mine too. Probably not. But I'm very excited to be able to share these things with you today. So I don't see any other questions. I want to just give it a moment. But there are some announcements and things that we wanted to share. Melissa says, thank you to the person who had Patty speak. Her encouragement was needed after a long, long day yesterday when I was depleted. And I understand there was a lot going on at the region floor, a lot of changes, a lot of debate and questions. So I can certainly understand y'all feeling like that. All right. I don't think there are any other questions. So I'm going to just say again, a heartfelt thank you, thank you, thank you to Patty. It has really been such an honor to hear you share your story. And I want to just take a moment and say thank you to all of our speakers over the course of this weekend. It has been so incredible to hear so many different voices. Your unique voice. That is what this conference has been all about. I think this convention has really conveyed to me personally the incredible beauty of hearing a person's unique story and hearing their diverse, disparate, different experiences and hearing OA in every single one of them. It has really been incredible. So I want to make a couple of announcements. I just want to say, first of all, that we had more than 250 tickets sold on Eventbrite, which is pretty darn cool, I think. I don't know the numbers of the money yet. We'll figure that out. But I added up all the attendees to each of our workshops. I think we had 15 workshops with more than 800 attendees. Holy cow, it is amazing. And I'm so grateful for that. Thank you everyone for coming. There's been so much participation in these workshops. Our speakers have been incredible, but we also have the recordings of people who shared afterwards and the questions that were asked and the information that has been so freely shared. All those recordings will be available. I think there was one, maybe two workshops that weren't recorded. We had some recording issues as it happens, but the vast majority of our workshops will be available online on our AtlantaOA.org website. And I'm gonna talk to Region. If they would like them, we're happy to share them as well. So we will I see a head nodding. So I think that's probably going to end up happening. So we will be getting those out as soon as we can. I happen to have an inside track on the guy who runs the website. So I'm hoping we can get those up real soon. I would like to also announce that April 1st through 3rd, 2022, Memphis, Tennessee, will be hosting the next region convention. Thank you, Memphis, so much for keeping this going, for providing a new wonderful venue for us to visit. We are so excited to join you in 6 months in Memphis. Yeah. I'm really excited about that. Okay. There's one more thing that I want to do, and one special thank you that I would like to say to all of our trusted servants. So get ready to raise your hand. Anybody in publicity, raise your hand. Let us see you. You can raise it on the participants. I guess if you wave, we might not see you. So anybody in publicity, please raise your hand. There are, yeah, there we go. There we go. We got some clapping going on. Go Lillian. She did such a great job. All right, everybody in registration, give me some hands up, hands up. What, what? That's right, that's right. Oh my great, googly moogly. These ladies have been killing it. They have been taking the names, doing the numbers, doing all that good stuff. All right, how about entertainment? Entertainment, give me a shout out. That's right, it's been awesome over in here. We had so much fun last night, you guys. All right, programming. Programming has been a huge job with this convention. Oh my goodness, all of our beautiful program committee members and Anne, our co-chair, and Bonita, our co-chair, y'all have just made it so phenomenal. And last but not least, I'm gonna have to raise my hand for this. We're talking about TechWeb. Give me a hand for TechWeb. Oh my gosh, and there are so many people. Holy cow, there are so many folks who have contributed to TechWeb. I wish now that I had done a head count, but I think that we had 19 members on our subcommittee, people who have shown up to do service at these workshops for the speakers all throughout the last 6 months. But today, yesterday, and Friday, I just want to say thank you from the very bottom of my heart. What an incredible experience. This has truly been a wonderful, wonderful time. And I am so grateful to be a part of it.
No, you, can't, you cannot close, Risa. You know the deal. I know what you're trying to do. And you cannot. You cannot. And I will not let you do what you're about to do. And first off, right, I'm going to tell y'all, we've been working on this longer than 6 months. So I guess Risa's so tired, she can't, her brain ain't even thinking right. But we've been doing this longer than 6 months. But all I want to say is, as much as everybody participated and everybody worked really hard, but if you at home and you can stand up, you need to stand up and give Risa a standing ovation, because there would not be a convention without Risa.
Hey, all right. Hey.
Wow. I don't care what was asked of her. She never said no. She said we figure it out, and she did. And so she does not. Are you red yet? Because I told you I was going to talk to your face turn red. I hope it's red. Oh, she's crying. Good.
I know this.
But Risa, we so happy for you, and I'm so grateful for all of your service. And I know everybody that worked is so happy, because you have helped every one of these, every part of this convention. You have helped everybody get everything done. So thank you so much for your service. And anyway, I look forward to doing some more stuff, because we got at least one more meeting, because we got to do wrap up, but that'll be in a couple of weeks. Oh Lord, it won't be this coming Saturday. Hallelujah.
We need to thank the interpreters too.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Interpreters, please raise your hand. Yes. I think you have been the hidden heroes of this convention.
Yes.
It has been incredible, the amount of time and energy and work that you're putting into this, and for free. I don't know if anyone knows that, but all of the interpreters who are here today have volunteered their time. They are members of OA. They are recovering compulsive overeaters, just like you, just like me, who are bringing recovery around the world. I think this is the first convention that has been in three languages.
And we just say that Can we admit right here that compulsive overeaters talk faster than anybody else? Right, translators?
Oh, you are so right about that. I have to tell you, reading slowly is like somebody in one of the previous workshops talked about having superpowers. And now I think it might be my new superpower. Learning how to read slow. Just pause, take a moment. The hardest thing I've ever done. All right. We're finishing a little bit early. So if there's anybody who wants to jump in real quick and say anything to close the convention, feel free.
My name is Calvin and I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hey, Calvin.
Hey, Calvin.
Outstanding. I didn't, you know, everybody has said it. The spirit is, I've gone to like a lot of us conventions over the years. Most of them until this year have been in person. But there has been a phenomenal spirit and grace in this meeting, and accolades to everyone who showed up and accolades whoever did the work. And Risa, I agree with everything Benita said. You are the queen of the show. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Y'all are going to give me a big head now. That's not right.
I just want to say something, another shout out to our interpreters. When I asked the group from Brazil, first of all, Dora invited me to the WhatsApp. There were more people on that website and in California, the Colombians, and they were so willing to help out. There were tons of them. And I just like to say thank you for their service.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm a recovering compulsive overeating food addict, and I just want to say what an honor it has been for me working with Benita as a co-chair, and all of you all who are always working together, always giving me the things that I needed when I didn't know what I was doing and when I needed help, always there for me and always there for each other. So I am so truly grateful to have worked with these group of people. And I have been truly blessed by all of the speakers and all of the service work that has been done to put this convention together. And I am so grateful and will be always eternally grateful for working with all of you all. It has been a pleasure as well as a privilege. And I just thank you so much. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks, Ann. Carol?
I'm Carol, compulsive overeater and food addict, and I want to do a shout out especially to the tech group. I can bear witness of the amount of work that went into what you were doing. I would say to all of you, the whole week, there has not been, I must have received about 100, 110 text messages a day. And even including recovery convention. They were just fantastic. They would start early in the morning, go to the end of the night, but I found that all of it was worth it because everything ran smoothly. And so I am grateful to all of you. And those who know me well. I'm not gonna call you out, but just glad to be here and what a marvelous convention, and hope I hear the tapes. I was on the business end. So thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Jinli?
Hi, thank you so much for this wonderful convention on Zoom so that I could come here from Hawaii. But two questions. Where will I be able to get the recordings? Because I know a few people that could benefit from listening to the wonderful speakers this weekend. And does this region host two a year then? Another conference is coming up? So I just wanted that.
So the recordings will be on atlantaoa.org. I put that in the chat so you can copy that. And yes, we host two conventions a year. It's been a little different for us with Zoom happening, but we've been making it work. And so we're happy for you to come and join us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
For sure. If you want to, you can go to SOAR Region 8. Is that the website? SOAR OA 8 SOAR. Could somebody put it in the chat?
OAregion8.org.
OAregion8.org. OAregion8.org.